What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Nurses. What was the darkest secret a patient ever confessed before dying? Story one. I was a hospice nurse for over a decade. One of my patients was a quiet old woman named Margaret. She was sweet, polite, and spent most of her time watching the birds outside her window. On the day she passed, she grabbed my wrist, harder than I thought she could, and said, "I never told anyone, not even God. But it's time." She confessed that in the 1960s, she had been a nurse herself in a psychiatric facility. Back then, electroshock therapy and straitjackets were still common. One patient, a young man with schizophrenia, had been locked away by his family because he was an embarrassment. Margaret said she fell in love with him. They used to whisper under the blankets at night. When the hospital decided he was no longer salvageable, she stole the key to the medication room and gave him an overdose of morphine. "He wasn't in pain," she whispered, "but they were going to take him apart. He asked me to do it, so I did." She died 5 minutes later, crying silently. Story two. I had a patient named Travis in his early 40s with terminal liver cancer. Rugged guy, tattoos, former Marine. He refused visitors, said he had no family. One night, he called me in, visibly panicked. He asked for a priest, but when I told him we didn't have one on call, he said I'd do. He told me he had been part of a private contractor team overseas after his military service. "We weren't just guarding oil fields," he said. "We were eliminating threats. I killed a kid, maybe 9 or 10. Thought he had a grenade. Just a toy truck." He couldn't stop crying. "They told me I was a hero. Gave me a medal. I threw it in a river." He looked me dead in the eyes and said, "You think pain ends when your body gives up? You think it just stops?" I didn't know how to answer. Story three. There was an elderly man named Mr. Blake, mid-stage dementia, but with moments of eerie clarity. One night he whispered, "I buried her under the orange tree. I thought it was another confused memory." I humored him and asked, "Who?" He looked straight at me and said, "My sister." In 1949, she was 5, I was 12. I told her to hide. I forgot to go back. He had tears rolling down his cheeks. "I lied. Said she wandered off. I was scared they'd blame me. And they did blame me. But not enough to dig." He died that same night. Out of curiosity, I Googled his hometown. There was an unsolved disappearance from that exact year. A girl named Evelyn, missing from her own yard. I'll never forget the way his eyes looked when he said, "I still hear her calling me in my dreams." Story four. I once took care of a woman in her 70s named Loretta. She had dementia, but in her final days, she kept repeating a name, Gabriel. We assumed it was a son or lover. Eventually, in a moment of clarity, she told me Gabriel wasn't a person. It was the name of her stillborn baby. But then she added something darker. "He wasn't stillborn. I smothered him." She said she'd been 17, terrified, unmarried in a deeply religious home. Her mother told her the baby was God's punishment. Loretta hid the pregnancy, delivered in the family basement, and when the baby cried, I panicked. I thought the devil had come for me. I just wanted it to stop. She never told anyone. Buried him in a shoebox beneath the garden. Her voice was nearly gone by the end. She kept whispering, "I'm sorry, Gabriel. I'm sorry, Gabriel," until she couldn't speak anymore. Story five. My patient, Ron, was an 89-year-old World War II vet. Funny guy. Loved to flirt with the nurses and tell war stories. Except one night, after a bad fever, he asked me if I believed in ghosts that carry guilt. I shrugged it off until he told me something I'll never unhear. He said his squad had captured a Nazi officer who had surrendered, but their commander wanted revenge for lost friends. "We tied him up in the barn," he said, eyes distant. "Said we were waiting for orders, but we never called it in. We left him. No food. No water, days." Ron was the one who found him, half mad, dehydrated, barely human. "I shot him," he said. "Just wanted to end it, but I still see his eyes. in dreams, in reflections. Before he died, he grabbed my hand and whispered, "It's never just war. There's always a part you can't bring home because it stays there, rotting." Story 6. I worked nights in a small rural hospital. One of our patients, a frail man in his 60s named Carl, was dying from advanced pancreatic cancer. He was lucid but quiet until his third night when he beckoned me over and asked, "Do you have kids?" I told him I didn't. "Good," he said, "because I used to teach Sunday school. Everyone trusted me. They left me alone with kids. I had a favorite, a little boy who reminded me of myself. One day I told him God wouldn't forgive liars and made him confess bad thoughts he didn't even have. Then I used that against him. He looked like he wanted me to stop listening, but I didn't. I ruined that boy's life. I saw him years later, homeless outside a train station. I walked past, couldn't even say sorry. I asked if he wanted me to call anyone. He said no one had spoken to him in 15 years. And that's the right amount of time for someone like me. Story 7. She was in her early 50s, lung cancer, barely able to breathe without assistance. Her name was Marianne, and she never had visitors. On her final night, she told me, "I need to confess something so someone remembers me as more than a fraud." She'd been a nurse for over 20 years herself. One day, early in her career, a patient came in with what she assumed was a minor allergic reaction. The chart was incomplete. She gave him the wrong dosage of medication. He started seizing right there in front of me. I froze. I couldn't call for help. I just watched. He died within minutes. I told the doctor he came in like that, and he believed me. They ruled it a heart attack. His wife was pregnant. She said she never told anyone, not even her husband. Every time someone said, "You're such a great nurse," it was like a dagger. She died before sunrise. Story 8. I had a patient once, Ms. Eleanor, who lived in a fancy retirement facility before she landed in our ward. She was elegant, always wearing pearls even in a hospital gown. As she got closer to the end, she'd drift in and out of lucidity. One night, she grabbed my wrist and asked, "Did you ever make a deal with something you don't understand?" I thought it was the morphine, but she was staring at me stone-cold sober. She said in the early 1970s, her child had fallen into their pool and stopped breathing. He was gone, blue, cold, and I ran into the woods. I don't know why. I just ran and screamed for anything to bring him back. According to her, a man in black appeared. He didn't speak. He just smiled. And when I got back, my son was coughing. Alive, then she whispered. But everything since has been wrong. He never aged right. Never felt real. And now, I think he's waiting for me. I don't know what was scarier, what she said or how sincere she looked saying it. Story 9. One patient, Mr. Adler, 78, was in for complications from a stroke. He barely spoke, but one night he motioned for me to come close and asked if I'd ever been in an orphanage. I hadn't. He nodded. "Good. Stay away from them." He went on to tell me that he and a friend escaped from one in 1954. They did experiments, he said. Not just discipline. Cold baths, isolation. They wired our heads to see how fear worked. They filmed it. Said it was for developmental research, but it was torture. My friend bit his own tongue off to make it stop. I was speechless. He said the place burned down years later, arson. They never proved it, but I did it. I poured gasoline in the basement, watched it go up with the rat still inside. He died the next morning. I looked up the name of the orphanage he mentioned. It really had burned down, and no one was ever charged. Story 10. Nora was only 36, dying of metastatic breast cancer. She always had a kind word for staff, but on her second to last night, she said, "I never told anyone, not even my husband." She had been an EMT before getting sick. She and her partner responded to a rollover on a mountain road one night. A father and his teenage daughter were trapped. The father died on impact. The girl was screaming, pinned. Then the car started smoking. Her partner froze. But Nora had to make a decision. "I dragged the wrong person out first. I saved the body of a man who was already gone, and by the time I got back and the car was gone too." She said the family thanked her for trying, sent her flowers. "But every time I see a teenage girl, I remember the sound she made, like an animal." I held her hand as she passed, tears in her eyes. Story 11. We had a patient named Harold, early 80s, multiple organ failure. He had the look of a grumpy grandpa. Never said much. On his final day, he motioned me closer and said, "Tell my son I'm sorry, but don't say what for." I told him I didn't know his son. "Then maybe it's better," he said. Eventually, he opened up. When he was in his 30s, his wife had a best friend who visited often. She came to us after her divorce, stayed in our guest room too long. One night, they were both drunk. I didn't say no. She didn't either. It was just bad. Months later, his wife found out. Not because the friend told, she didn't, but because she got pregnant. His wife miscarried around the same time. She never put it together, but I did. I always did. My son is probably not mine, but I couldn't undo anything. He choked as he said, "He calls me dad. He gave me grandkids, and I let him live a lie." He passed without ever telling him. I still wonder if I should have tried. Story 12. A man named Victor came in after a cardiac arrest. We revived him, but it was clear he didn't have long. His first question when he woke was, "Did you see the dog?" I figured it was post-revival confusion, but he was completely serious. He said that as a teenager, he and some friends broke into an abandoned shelter. It was supposed to be a prank. They freed all the dogs, filmed it, laughed, but one pit bull wouldn't leave. It cowered in a corner, shivering. "We were drunk, stupid. One of the guys said we had to make him run." Victor found a firecracker and lit it near the dog, but it caught fire. The dog didn't run. It burned. I still hear it, not barking, not screaming, just the silence after. He told me after his first heart attack, he started seeing a black dog in dreams. It waits. It's patient. He died that night during a second cardiac arrest. I checked his chart later. The timestamp of death? Exactly midnight. I'll never forget that. Story 13. This one still messes with me. Patient named Sarah, 44, end-stage ALS. Could barely move, but mentally sharp. She always smiled for the staff, always said thank you. On her third week, she asked if I could keep a secret, not because I want forgiveness, just for someone to know. At age 19, she'd gotten pregnant. Her strict religious parents would have disowned her. She hid it, wrapped sweaters around her stomach, gave birth in a bathroom at a Greyhound station. She didn't want to give the baby away, but she didn't have a plan. I left him in the stall. I didn't look back. When the news covered it, she told people she was horrified, even volunteered at a shelter to prove to herself she was good again. "But I never tried to find him. Never checked if he lived or died," she said. "Everyone thinks I'm this brave woman dying too young. They don't know I was a coward long before this disease." She died before I had a chance to respond. Story 14. A woman named Margot, 72, was in with late-stage colon cancer. She was funny, blunt, had no filter. On her last day, she pulled me close and said, "Want to hear how I got rich?" She told me she had worked in a financial firm in the 80s. Her boss was under investigation for embezzlement. One night, he called me in. Said he had dirt on everyone. Asked if I wanted in or out. She chose in. Helped forge documents, rerouted money, and kept quiet while others went to prison. Her boss fled the country. She stayed. "They never suspected me. I played the dumb assistant." Years later, the firm collapsed. She sold the house, changed her name, bought a beach condo under an LLC. "I've been living on guilt for 30 years, and interest." She took a deep breath, smiled, and said, "I always wondered if I'd go to hell for it, but now I think hell is just waiting to die. Knowing the worst thing you ever did paid your bills." She died that night, alone, wealthy, and terrified. Story 15. This guy named Eli, mid-30s, came in for end-stage kidney failure. He'd refused transplants, dialysis, everything. Said he didn't deserve it. We all thought he was just giving up, until he told me why. "When I was 19, I worked as a bouncer. One night I kicked a guy out. Didn't know he was drunk and diabetic. He collapsed outside. I thought he was faking. I didn't call for help. The man died." His mother came to the club the next day, begging to know what happened. Eli lied, said he'd already left. "It never left me. Every time I looked in the mirror, I saw her face. Not his, hers." Years later, Eli got sick. He refused every treatment. Said he didn't want to trade a stolen life for borrowed time. I asked if he ever told his own mom. He laughed bitterly. She thinks I'm brave. Maybe it's better she does. Story 16. I had a long-term ICU patient named Gloria. Late 60s, severe sepsis. She was in and out of consciousness for days. Then one night, fully lucid, she asked if she could speak without judgment. I nodded. She said, I was a wet nurse in the 1980s. People think it stopped in the old days, but wealthy families still hired women to nurse their babies, quietly. She worked for a politician's family. The wife couldn't produce milk. Gloria fed the baby, bathed him, rocked him to sleep. He was more mine than hers. One day, the wife said she was tired of trying. Her husband suggested adoption. They planned to give him away like a pet, she said. So I made a phone call, told my sister to lose the baby paperwork, falsified the transfer papers. I had him declared dead. She said the baby went to her cousin's family in Alabama. He grew up never knowing, and now he's in law school. I asked if she ever saw him again. Every year on his birthday, I drive by the old farm and sit in my car. I don't knock. Story 17. One of my patients, Darnell, was a quiet Vietnam vet. Died from lung cancer, smoked all his life. The day before he passed, he told me, "You know, Agent Orange, that wasn't the worst thing we dropped." I assumed he was confused. But then he added, I saw a village once. We were told to clear it. Radio silence. No survivors, no dogs, no crops, no names. He paused. But there were kids, not soldiers, kids. We were supposed to leave them, let them starve, but one guy panicked, started shooting. We all followed. Darnell said he spent every Veterans Day alone, not out of shame, but because I don't deserve to stand beside the ones who didn't pull that trigger. He wrote a letter every year to someone named Mai. Never mailed them. He asked me to burn them with him when he died. I did. Story 18. Catherine was in her early 40s. She'd survived ovarian cancer once, but it came back with a vengeance. She had two kids, a husband who adored her. But one night, she told me something that haunted her more than dying. I used to work as a hotel housekeeper in Vegas. I cleaned suites. One day I found a baby, crying in a drawer. She called the front desk. Security came. Cops came. Eventually, a young couple arrived, crying, panicked, said they forgot him during checkout. They were high, really high, barely aware of the baby's name. The police let them go with a warning. CPS didn't even get involved. I found the baby again a week later. Same room, different name on the reservation, same couple. This time, she said nothing. I took him, left the job. Faked adoption papers. Moved states. That baby? Her son now? He's 17. He doesn't know. Thinks I'm his real mom. I don't care if it's wrong. It was the only thing I've ever done right. Story 19. A guy named Sergio came in after an overdose. We got him stable for a few days. He knew he wouldn't make it. On his final night, he said, I wasn't a bad dad, but I was a bad brother. Turns out, when he was a teenager, he and his older brother had an abusive stepfather. One night it went too far. My brother pushed him down the stairs. He didn't move. They both stood there, silent. I told my mom I saw my brother do it on purpose. I told the cops he laughed after. None of it was true. His brother went to juvie. Got out years later but never spoke to the family again. Sergio said, he sends postcards sometimes, but he never puts a return address. I asked why he lied.
Because I was scared. But mostly, I was jealous. My stepdad loved him more, or maybe I just thought he did.
He asked me to write a letter, not an apology, just an explanation. He died before I finished. Story 20. Helen was 91. Her body was fading fast, but her memory was crystal clear. She'd lived through the war, the Depression, the civil rights movement. She saw everything. But what she told me, I wasn't ready for it. In 1957, she worked in a small-town clinic. One day, a white mother came in with a black newborn. She said the father was a mistake, asked if we took care of things like this. Helen said no. But the next day, she returned, with the baby wrapped in a blanket, said it was handled, left it in our dumpster. Helen couldn't bring herself to tell anyone. She took the baby, cleaned him, wrapped him up, and left him in front of a church two towns over. I didn't want to raise him. I didn't want to bury him. I just wanted someone to love him. Years later, she saw a photo in the paper, a man named Elijah, adopted, now a city councilman. It was him. I knew it was him. I've been watching his career ever since.
she whispered. I just needed to tell someone I did one thing right. Story 21. One of my patients was a man named Alvin, mid-70s, bedridden with pneumonia complications. He had a thick southern accent and a preacher's voice, but he didn't want a chaplain. Instead, one evening, he asked if I'd sit with him and hear his sin. He told me he'd spent most of his life running a church in Georgia. Well-respected. Loved. But early in his ministry, a teenage girl came to him and said one of the deacons had been inappropriate. Alvin asked for proof. She cried and begged, but he said without witnesses, he couldn't ruin a man's reputation. She stopped coming. A year later, she died by suicide. I buried her, preached her funeral, called her a troubled soul, but I was the troubled one. He said the deacon retired with honors, moved to Florida. He lived a full life, and she never made it past 17. Alvin never told anyone. He just kept climbing the church ranks. Before he passed, he said, "If hell is real, I'll be preaching in it." Story 22. I once took care of a woman named Joy, who was in her 50s but looked older. Liver failure, long-term alcoholic. Quiet, always polite. On her final day, she said she wanted to confess something she couldn't carry anymore. She told me she used to work as a caretaker for a wealthy family. The mother was distant, the father was handsy. She said nothing, needed the job. But she got close to their daughter Sophie, who was 8 at the time. One night, Joy found the little girl crying in the bathroom. When she asked what happened, Sophie said, "Daddy said I was special." That night, Joy packed a bag, took the girl while the parents slept, and left. I drove all night to a shelter 2 states away. Said I found her, gave them a fake name. Then I left her there. Joy never checked what happened next. She kept moving cities. I didn't want them to find me. But I also didn't want to know if they found her. She looked at me with teary eyes and whispered, "I didn't save her. I just passed her along and ran." Story 23. There was a woman named Diane, late 80s, with heart failure. Sharp as a tack until the end. She was charming, dignified, and had a photo of a young man beside her bed. One night, she pointed to it and asked, "Do you believe in love curses?" I smiled politely, but she was dead serious. She said she'd been in love with that man in 1952. His name was Henry, but Henry was engaged to her sister. He told me he loved me too. We kissed once. Just once. Then he married her anyway. Diane was furious. She went to a woman in her town, the kind they called witches back then, and begged her to do something. She gave Diane a pouch of ash and herbs and said, "Burn this and speak his name at midnight." Diane did it. 2 days later, Henry died in a car crash. Her sister never remarried. Diane never dated again. "I got what I wanted," she said. "But it didn't bring him to me. It just took him away from both of us." She died whispering his name. Story 24. A man named Josh came into our unit with advanced AIDS. He was young, maybe 30, and mostly alone. Toward the end, I stayed with him during the night shifts. We talked about everything. Then one night he told me, "There's a tape buried in a box in my mom's attic." He explained that when he was a teenager, he had a friend named Billy. They were inseparable, but Billy's dad was a known bigot. He hated gay people, and he knew we were close. One night, Billy snuck into Josh's house. They kissed for the first time. The next day, Billy didn't show up at school. Josh found out he'd died by suicide. "But I didn't believe it," he said. "He left me a note, said they know." A week later, Josh broke into Billy's house, stole a security tape, and buried it. I don't know if it proves anything, but I think his dad did something, or made him do it. He asked me not to retrieve the tape. If the truth didn't save him then, it won't save me now. Story 25. Mr. Watkins was 95, a former prison warden. He had a booming voice even in a hospital bed. Most of the staff found him intimidating, but one night he asked to speak privately. What he told me made my skin crawl. Back in the 1960s, a man named Elias was sentenced to death. "I knew he was innocent," he said. "Everyone did. But the governor needed a win, and I needed my pension." He said he helped falsify records, made it look like Elias confessed in private. There was no recording, just my word. That's all it took. Watkins said he shook Elias's hand before the execution. He looked me in the eye and said, "I'll wait for you." Ever since, Watkins said he'd see Elias in dreams, standing still,
never blinking. He doesn't age, just watches. He died in his sleep. But hours before, he said, he's closer now. I can feel him. Story 26. Gregory was 61, dying from complications related to diabetes. He didn't talk much until the final two nights when he became oddly reflective. You ever take something so small it ruins everything? He asked. Back in 1991, he worked as a delivery driver. One night, he made a stop at a gas station and saw a man leave a briefcase on the counter. No one saw it. I took it. Thought maybe it had cash or something. Inside, blueprints, legal files, a laptop, and a hard drive. The briefcase belonged to an environmental whistleblower testifying against a major chemical company. Gregory panicked. Instead of turning it in, he sold the contents to a guy in a bar for $400. Weeks later, he saw a news story. The whistleblower had gone missing. A body was later found in a creek. Gregory never spoke about it again. I thought I was stealing a sandwich, not a man's voice. Before dying, he said, I wonder if he had kids. I hope they never find out I was part of the silence. Story 27. There was a woman named Carol in our dementia ward. She had moments of stunning clarity before slipping away again. One evening, she whispered, I was a mother before I was anyone else. She talked about her first child, born in secret when she was just 16. My parents told the neighbors I'd gone to visit cousins for the summer, but really I gave birth in a Catholic home for girls like me. Her parents forced her to sign adoption papers before she held him. But a year later, she saw a child in a grocery store with her exact birthmark. I knew it was him. I just knew. So she followed the couple home. For months. Obsessed. One night, she snuck into their backyard just to watch him sleep through a window. And then I opened it. I almost took him. I even lifted him. But he stirred and she froze. I put him back, tucked the blanket in, and ran. She never saw him again. Never told anyone. I was too much of a mother to steal him, and too much of a coward to fight for him. Story 28. A terminal patient named Dennis, mid-50s, told me a story I still think about. He was a fire inspector. Respected, trained. But he said, there's a fire I never reported right. It was in an apartment complex in 2003. A small electrical fire. He found that the landlord had illegally tampered with the wiring. But the landlord was a personal friend, someone who had loaned him money after his divorce. I filed the report. I just omitted a few things. 3 months later, the building caught fire again. This time it spread. A woman and her 3-year-old son died in the stairwell. The fire was ruled an accident, but it wasn't. I could have saved them. One signature, one report. I traded it for loyalty. He asked if I believed in ghosts. Sometimes I smell burning plastic in places where it doesn't make sense. My closet, my car, my breath. He died the next day. His last words were, "It's smoky in here." There wasn't a single fire alarm going off. Story 29. A woman named Teresa came in for heart failure. She was extremely private, barely spoke, but during her final few hours, she asked me, "Do you think anyone can really love someone who can't love back?" She explained she'd been married 3 times, all short-lived. She never cried during breakups, never felt anything when her mother died. "I think I was born broken," but what haunted her wasn't the absence of love. It was how she faked it. I used to volunteer for terminal kids, read to them, held them, kissed their heads, but not because I cared. I wanted to see if I could care. One boy, David, got attached. He told his parents, "Miss Teresa loves me. I know it." He made her a bracelet from string and shells. When he died, his mom handed it to her and said, "You gave him peace." Teresa wore the bracelet for 20 years. Not out of love, out of guilt. "He died thinking I gave him something I didn't even possess." Her voice shook for the first time. "He gave me everything. I gave him a performance." Story 30. My patient was a woman named Nyla, 38. With terminal cervical cancer. She was an artist, painted murals, always had color under her nails. But toward the end, she said something that stuck with me. "There's a man in prison who thinks he's a monster, but I made him one." She told me that in college, she had a roommate who was assaulted at a party. The police did nothing. So Nyla took justice into her own hands. She picked a guy from the party, someone loud, drunk, and easy to hate,
and filed a false report. He had a record. I knew it would stick, and it did. Years later, she found out her roommate had lied. She was never assaulted, just humiliated and wanted revenge. Nyla tried to retract the statement, but it was too late. The man had already served time and lost everything. I ruined someone's life over a lie that wasn't even mine. She painted murals on prison outreach centers as penance. I hope he never sees one. I hope he forgets my name. She passed with her eyes wide open, like she still hadn't forgiven herself. Story 31. I once had a patient named Gerald, a retired zookeeper dying from lung cancer. He was eccentric, loved to tell stories about elephants and parrots. But on his final night, he asked me to shut the door and whispered, "There's something I've never told anyone." Back in the 1980s, a child went missing at the zoo. The story was in the news for days. They said the kid wandered off and was never found. But Gerald said that wasn't true. I was off my shift, smoking behind the reptile house. I heard a noise. It was the kid. He'd slipped through a barrier into the croc pit. No one else saw. I froze. Instead of calling for help, he left. He walked away, got in his car, and drove home. I didn't want to be blamed. Didn't want the press. I convinced myself someone else would find him. The next day, they drained the pit. Nothing. No body. The zoo blamed the mother. Gerald kept quiet for decades. I still see his little shoes in my sleep. Still hear the splash. Story 32. My patient's name was Masha. She was a refugee from the Balkans, late 70s, with terminal kidney failure. Quiet, polite, always reading. But on her third night, she asked, "What do you do with memories too ugly for prayer?" She told me that during the Yugoslav wars, she'd worked as a nurse in a field hospital. Supplies were limited. One day, a group of armed men brought in a wounded boy, barely 14, who'd been caught stealing rations. They said he was a traitor and demanded she patch him up enough to talk. She did. Then they left him alone with her for the night. He begged her to kill him, said they'd tortured him already, said they'd do worse if he talked. "I didn't give him a lethal dose," she said, "but I injected a sedative, and I loosened his restraints." He ran. They found him hanging from a tree the next morning. I gave him a choice. I told myself that made it merciful, but I still hear the rope creak in my dreams. Story 33. A man named Peter, mid-40s, came in with stage 4 colon cancer. He had an easy smile, a wedding ring, and 3 kids. But one night, he broke down completely. "I'm not who they think I am," he said. He told me that in his early 20s, he worked in IT at a major university. One day, he found access to the admin server. He snooped. Then he got greedy. He started altering grades, first for himself, then for others, for money. Over 2 years, he made $200,000. The school knew something was wrong, but never traced it to me. I got out before they caught on. He used that money to start a business, which helped pay for his house, wedding, and even his kids' school tuition. I built a perfect life out of someone else's broken rules. He never told his wife, never even hinted. I'm the family man on the porch, but I'm also the ghost in that server. He asked me to delete an old hard drive stored in his garage. I never did. Story 34. Evelyn was 83 and incredibly religious. She wore a rosary even while sleeping. But the day before she passed, she gripped my hand and whispered, "The devil never forgets a favor." She explained that when she was 19, she was assaulted by her cousin. Her family dismissed it, said I must have provoked him. 2 years later, the cousin had a daughter. Perfect child, adored by everyone. Evelyn watched for years as her own pain was ignored. And then one night when she was babysitting, she gave the little girl cough syrup. Too much. Far too much. "She didn't die," she said, "but she had a seizure, lost oxygen. She was never the same." The family called it a medical fluke. Evelyn played the concerned aunt. They never suspected. They called it God's will, but she always knew. "She didn't deserve it, but I needed someone else to hurt like I did." She died choking on her own breath, like her secret finally turned physical. Story 35. A patient named Wes, 68, had ALS. He could barely move or speak, but he still had sharp eyes. One night, blinking through a speech device, he typed out, "I buried something in my yard." I thought he meant valuables, maybe a will, but over 2 hours with agonizing taps, he typed a name, Stephanie. He said he was 22. She was his neighbor. They dated. Then she got pregnant. She wanted to keep it, I didn't. One night, during an argument, she slipped and hit her head on a coffee table. She wasn't moving. I waited. No breathing. I panicked. He said he wrapped her in tarp, drove to the woods behind his property, and buried her under a pine tree. Told everyone she ran off with a trucker. Years later, he sold the house, moved states, married someone else. No one ever found her, not even a trace. I check every year. Still nothing. He died 2 days later. I checked public records. Stephanie Walters, age 19, missing since 1976. Case unsolved. Story 36. Her name was Judith. She was in her early 60s, battling end-stage breast cancer. She was the kind of patient who smiled too much, joked too quickly, like she was hiding something. On her final night, she told me she used to be a 911 operator. One night in the late 80s, she got a call from a little boy. He whispered, "I think my dad is hurting my mom." She dispatched a unit, standard procedure. But then he said, "He's coming." He sees me. Then silence. The call disconnected. She panicked and tried to trace it, but something in the system glitched. No backup number, no address. I had one job. I failed it. For weeks, she watched the news. No matching report, nothing. She eventually convinced herself it was a prank or a mistake. Then 10 years later, she said, I saw the name again, kid's name, on a missing persons cold case site. Picture looked just like the voice sounded. She never told anyone. I've saved lives, but I think I let that one die. Story 37. Raymond, 87, with congestive heart failure, was one of those stoic old men who never complained, never cried. But on his final day, he gripped my forearm and said, "It's my fault my brother died." He told me that as kids in the 1940s, they shared a room and fought constantly. One day, during a heat wave, they argued over a broken fan. His brother wanted to sleep on the porch. Their mom said no. Raymond told him to sneak out anyway. "Grow a pair," he said. That night, the boy went out the window and fell from the second-story roof. Snapped his neck. Dead on impact. Raymond told the police he didn't know anything. Said his brother probably just wanted to stargaze. His mom never forgave herself. But it was me. I dared him, teased him. I wanted the room to myself. He carried it for over 70 years. Every time I get sick, I think, maybe this is him, coming back to take what's owed. Story 38. She was a nun, Sister Marie, 91 years old, frail, almost weightless in the bed. She had colon cancer and asked for no extraordinary measures. On her second night, she asked if she could confess, not to a priest, but to me. She said that in 1954, she was stationed at a Catholic boarding school. One of the girls, Annalise, was always disruptive, talked too much, laughed too loud. Marie had punished her often. One winter, Annalise disappeared. The official story was that she ran away. But Marie told me something else. She snuck into the chapel after dark. I found her there, mocking the organ music. I grabbed her, slapped her. She ran out the back door. It was snowing hard. She never came back. They searched, blamed the woods. But I never told them I pushed her. Marie paused. I was young, full of wrath. I told myself it was discipline, but it was pride. She died the next morning with her rosary twisted around her hands like shackles. Story 39. Patient named Deshaun, late 30s, shot in a gang-related incident. We tried everything, but the damage was too severe. He knew he was dying. As I sat with him, he looked at me and asked, "You ever hear about the Clark Street fire?" I had. It was a fire in an abandoned apartment complex that killed 6 people, mostly squatters. Arson suspected, never solved. "That was me," he said. "I was 16. We lit it for fun, thought it would just burn the first floor. But the wind shifted. Went up like paper. He and 2 friends ran. We didn't know people were inside until the next day. One of the victims was a pregnant woman. He kept her picture folded in his wallet. I carry her face so I don't forget who I owe. He told me he turned his life around because of that. But I never turned myself in. And that makes everything I did after fake. He asked me to call a specific number. Tell my mom I wasn't perfect, but I tried. Story 40. Lucinda was in her 70s. Elegant, stern, one of those women who wore lipstick even in a hospital gown. She had terminal liver failure, didn't flinch when told she was dying. But on her last night, she asked me, "Do you know what it's like to bury two husbands and love neither?" She explained she'd been married twice. Her first husband was kind, dull, loyal. The second was cruel, magnetic, exciting. She stayed with both out of convenience. But the truth she'd never told anyone? I poisoned them, not with arsenic or bleach, with food, salt, butter, alcohol. I overfed the diabetic. I refilled the bourbon for the alcoholic, slowly, patiently. Doctors called them natural deaths, and they were. But I helped nature along. I asked if she regretted it. "I regret that I waited so long to enjoy being alone." She died in silence, as if she'd finally made peace with herself, because no one else ever could. Story 41. A man named Ben came in with advanced bone cancer. He was only 43, had a wife and two daughters. On his final night, he couldn't sleep. He stared at the ceiling and said, "I shouldn't have left the note." When I asked what he meant, he told me that 10 years earlier, his coworker, Jason, was getting promoted. Ben had wanted the role, but Jason got it. He was a nice guy. That was the worst part. In a moment of rage, Ben created an anonymous email, said Jason had been stealing from the company, provided fake bank screenshots, even left a printed note in the break room that read, "I'm not the thief they think I am." Jason was fired, lost his pension, divorced. 6 months later, he took his own life. "The day he died, I deleted everything. I got the promotion." Ben said the guilt made him start drinking. Drinking led to poor health. "It all came full circle. I killed him, and now I'm rotting the same way." He asked me to find Jason's family and tell them the truth. I didn't. Story 42. I had a patient named Dolores. She was 90 and sharp as a tack, though dying from pneumonia. She insisted on sleeping upright and always clutched a faded photograph of a little boy. She asked me one night, "Have you ever stolen a life? Not by killing, but by pretending it was yours?" Back in the 1960s, she was a nanny for a wealthy couple in New York. The mother died in childbirth. The father was rarely home. Dolores raised the boy, loved him like her own. When the father died suddenly in a car crash, his estranged family contested custody. Dolores fled with the child. I changed our names, moved to Arizona. I told him I adopted him from an orphanage. The boy grew up believing Dolores was his savior. He never knew he had uncles, cousins, a trust fund. He died of leukemia at 24, never knowing where he came from. I didn't steal him, I just couldn't let him go, but now I wonder what he could have had. Story 43. Jared was 56 and dying from liver failure. He'd worked as a public school janitor for most of his life. Everyone described him as quiet and kind, but one night he said to me, "Sometimes good men get bored." When I asked what he meant, he told me that over 15 years, he'd written anonymous letters to students' parents. Nothing illegal, just disturbing. I'd accuse them of lying, of cheating, of drinking too much. Just vague enough to sound real. He said he did it because he liked watching how quickly a calm life could unravel. One letter said, "Your daughter doesn't tell you everything, does she?" Another simply read, "He doesn't work late. You know that, right?" He'd mail them from random locations, never signed, never traced. "I saw a marriage break down in real time because of one sentence I wrote," he said, "all from a mop closet." When I asked if he ever got caught, he laughed and said, "You only get caught if you want to be." Story 44. There was a woman named Farah, 67, dying from ALS. She couldn't speak, so she used an eye-controlled device to type. It took her over an hour to write 3 sentences, but what she wrote stunned me. "The baby was mine. I left her in the motel. I watched them find her on the news. I assumed she meant her child, but no." She explained slowly that when she was 18, she worked in a motel outside Reno. One night, a woman checked in, clearly distressed, with a baby. She left at 2 a.m. and never returned. Farah took the baby, fed her, held her. But then she panicked. "I thought they'd think I took her, or worse." So she wrapped the child in towels, left her in the alley behind a hospital, and called 911 from a payphone. She watched the story unfold on TV. Missing infant. Abandoned child. She never came forward. I wasn't the villain, but I wasn't the mother either. I was just the one who did nothing. Story 45. My patient was a man named Leonard, 84. He was polite, always asked for his meals with a please and thank you. The day before he died, he said, I used to work in a courthouse, custodial staff. I saw something I wasn't meant to see. It was 1972. A judge, a prosecutor, and a cop were laughing in the hallway. They were celebrating a conviction. Leonard overheard them joking that the man they convicted was innocent, but he fit the part and the papers needed a win. Leonard said nothing. He needed the job. He was raising three kids alone. But later that night, he snuck into the records room and took the case file, hid it under his floorboards for decades. I thought I'd go back, try to fix it. But then the guy died in prison, and I told myself it was too late. He handed me the file before he passed. I still have it.